Well, brethren, as we all know, in the Church of God, every year we make a specific point of honoring and keeping God's annual holy days that we know are listed in Leviticus chapter 23. But, you know, sometimes I think when we read over that chapter in Leviticus 23, because, you know, it's our go-to chapter for God's holy days, there's a distinction that we should notice in that chapter that oftentimes we read over and we just don't really see. And what I mean by that is this chapter tells us this is a list of God's appointed times. It also mentions his holy convocations. But we oftentimes will assume that those two are one and the same. You know, that every appointed time is a holy convocation, or a Sabbath, as we more commonly would refer to it as. And that's actually not correct. While it is true that every Sabbath or holy convocation, as, you know, the chapter refers to it as, is an appointed time, not every appointed time is a Sabbath or a holy convocation, because there is an important distinction between the two. So what we're going to do today is look at this particular subject in this sermon and understand, again, not only this distinction, but particularly look at two very specific appointed times that are mentioned in this chapter that have very significant meanings, but as we're going to see, God chose not to make them Sabbaths or holy convocations. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's "Not All Appointed Times Are Sabbaths." Again, not all appointed times are Sabbaths. Because as we're going to see, the term holy convocation that's used here is basically synonymous with the term Sabbath that we typically use. But turn over to start off with Leviticus 23. Again, Leviticus 23. As we all know, this is, you know, typically our go-to chapter whenever we're addressing God's holy days, because they're all, you know, listed here in order. But start here in Leviticus 23 in verse 1. It says, "And Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, The feasts of Jehovah, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." Now, when you read this verse the way it's written in English, you get the impression that feasts and holy convocations, well, that's one and the same. Those are synonymous terms. Well, as we're going to see when we look, you know, read through this, actually, if we pay attention to the details in the chapter, that's not an accurate assumption. As I mentioned, all holy convocations are appointed times, or, you know, the word here is feast, is how it's in English, but we're going to see what it means is appointed times. You know, while all holy convocations are appointed times, all appointed times are not necessarily holy convocations, because there is a difference here. Now, if you take a Bible search program, you know, kind of a computer program where it makes it easy to, you know, type in words and find everywhere they show up in the Bible, and you type in the words holy convocation, you're going to see a very, very consistent trend. 100% of the time, whenever you see the words holy convocation, it's referring to either the weekly Sabbath or an annual Sabbath, one of the holy days that is specifically a Sabbath. Because you'll see when a holy convocation is mentioned, you're typically going to see the words, "You shall do no work," you know, because it's specifically telling you, you know, this is a 24-hour period, you know, from sundown to sundown. You know, this is a designated Sabbath. You don't do any work on this, and it calls it a holy convocation. However, there are appointed times, as we're going to see here, that are not called out as holy convocations. Now, to shed a little light on this, let's notice, first of all, that here in verse 2, the word feast, it's used twice, and it's translated from the same Hebrew word. Now, just to add a little more context here, and we won't go into all the nuances of this today, but oftentimes when we read through the Bible and we see the word feast mentioned, you know, particularly in the Old Testament. Now, for us in English, it all sounds the same, you know, but there are actually several Hebrew words, you know, that are different and have different nuances to them that are oftentimes translated into the English word feast. You know, so again, it's not always synonymous in saying the exact same thing, but reading in English, you don't realize that, you know, because you're just reading the same English word. Now, the Hebrew here that's translated as feast, you know, both times here in verse 2, comes from the Hebrew word moed. It's transliterated into English as M-O-E-D. It's Strong's number 4150, and the definition I'm about to read to you comes from the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter. And they define the word as, quote, "a masculine noun meaning an appointed time or place. It can signify an appointed meeting time in general, a specific appointed time, usually for a sacred feast or festival, the time of the bird's migration, the time of wine, the same time next year. In addition to the concept of time, this word can also signify an appointed meeting place. So as you can see there, this word can be used kind of in a broad sense in a number of contexts. But obviously how it's being used here in Leviticus 23 is referring to an appointed time. But as we want you to see here, as we read through the chapter, we're going to notice, you know, we have a list of appointed times here, but it's going to call out several of them as holy convocations and others that are not holy convocations. And it's important to pay attention to that. So let's continue on in verse 3 here. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. So he's telling us the weekly Sabbath is a holy convocation. Now notice the next phrase, you shall do no work on it. It is the Sabbath of Jehovah in all your dwellings. As I mentioned before, if you do a search on the words holy convocation, you're going to find it always refers to either the weekly Sabbath or an annual Sabbath, and you're typically also going to see the words you shall do no work on it. You know, it's specifically telling you this is a Sabbath. You know, this is sundown to sundown on a particular day. You know, and that day is set aside as holy time. You should do no work on it. But again, as we read through this chapter, again, we're going to find not all the times that are called out as appointed times are holy convocations. In fact, we're going to focus on two particular, you know, very significant appointed times that have very significant meanings of what they point to, but that God didn't make holy convocations or Sabbaths. Now continue in verse 4. These are the feasts, or the appointed times, of Jehovah, holy convocations which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. Now again, that would sound like, when you read this in English, like a holy convocation and an appointed time, or that's synonymous terms, you know, one and the same. But let's pay attention to the details as we keep reading, and it will become obvious that's not the case. In verse 5, on the 14th day of the first month at twilight is Jehovah's Passover. Now we're going to come back in a minute here and focus more in detail on this verse, but just take note of the fact here, nothing is said about a holy convocation, nothing is said about you shall do no work on it, because we're going to see Passover as an appointed time, not a Sabbath or a holy convocation. But if you just keep reading in the next couple of verses here, the distinction between, again, appointed times and holy convocations is going to become clear. In verse 6, and on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to Jehovah. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. And notice all 7 days are pointed out, and you have a specific command that you have to do on all 7 days because you must eat unleavened bread. Now, it doesn't mention the command here in these verses to, you know, to not have any leavening, you know, in your premises during that time, but you'll find that in Exodus 13. But again, you can see that there are specific instructions that you should do for all 7 days. And as we keep reading the next couple of verses, well, notice that there are sacrifices they were commanded to do all 7 days. But it's going to point out two of these days as holy convocations that are different from the others of 5 days. So keep reading here in verse 7. And on the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. As I mentioned, when you see holy convocation, you normally see do no customary work. In verse 8. But you shall offer an offering made by fire to Jehovah for 7 days. Again, there's instructions for all 7 days. They're all appointed times. But then now read the last sentence. The seventh day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. I notice it pointed out all 7 days as an appointed time. There are specific instructions. You know, you should have to eat unleavened bread. You know, you have to have the leavening out of your home. You know, during that time, that's not specifically mentioned here, but again, it is in other verses. You know, there were sacrifices they had to do all 7 days. They're all, you know, appointed times, but only two of those days were holy convocations. You shall do no work, because there's a difference between, you know, Sabbaths or holy convocations and appointed times. They're not, you know, completely synonymous terms. And that's important to understand, particularly if we go back now and look at verse 5 and dig into the details here. Now, let's read verse 5 again. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is Jehovah's Passover. Now, this is not as clear in the English here, but if you look at the word at twilight and dig into the meaning there, what you're going to find is this is a Hebrew phrase, ben harbihim. It is typically in English would be between the two evenings. Now, that's a hotly debated term, and we're not going to get into trying to solve that particular debate today, but I just want you to make an obvious observation with this. You know, the two most common theories that are typically argued about how to interpret Ben Harbihim. One is that the definition of Ben Harbihim is the time between sunset and dark at the beginning of a day, you know, approximately about a period of an hour. The other common argument is it's an afternoon time frame, and it refers to, you know, kind of the early afternoon when the sun starts to, you know, make its descent in the sky, you know, from that point down to sunset, which is a several hour window of time. Now, again, I'm not going to get into all the debates about which one is correct, but there is an obvious lesson here that is true regardless of which argument you want to make and which theory you think is correct. We're talking about a window of time on a day. We're not talking about a whole day. It's not saying that the 14th as a whole, you know, just the day, you know, sunset to sunset is defined as Passover. No, it's saying Passover is an appointed time, and that appointed time is on the 14th between the two evenings. It's a window of time. Again, you can argue whether it's that hour, you know, between sunset and dark, or it's several hours between early afternoon and sunset. Either way, you know, what you've clearly got is a window of time on a day. So the appointed time of Passover, you know, the definition of Passover, because notice here it says, you know, that on the 14th day of the first month at twilight, at Ben Harbihim, between the two evenings, is Jehovah's Passover. That's the definition of Passover, is what takes place in that appointed time between the two evenings. You know, so that's what the Bible is calling Passover. You know, now to add a little more insight to this, turn over to Numbers chapter 9. Numbers chapter 9, we'll see this mentioned here as well. And now what we're going to see here is the same Hebrew word used, you know, moed, but it's going to be translated here in Numbers 9 as appointed time rather than as feast, but it's the same word that Leviticus 23 uses. Now start here in Numbers 9 in verse 2. It says, let the children of Israel keep Passover at its appointed time, at its moed. Again, same word that we saw in Leviticus 23. On the 14th day of this month at twilight, again, in Hebrew, that's Ben Harbihim, that's between the two evenings, you shall keep it at its appointed time, at its moed. According to all of its rites and ceremonies, you shall keep it. So Moses told the children of Israel that they should keep the Passover. And they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month at twilight, you know, again, between the two evenings, in the wilderness of Sinai, according to all that Jehovah commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did. So you can see here what we've got is, again, an appointed time. That appointed time, and again, is a section of time on the 14th. He's not saying that the 14th as a whole, as a day, you know, from sunset to sunset is the appointed time. He's saying, no, it's a window of time on that day. And again, to understand, you know, what it's specifically calling Passover, we just have to look at what takes place during that window of time. Because, see, the definition of Passover, it's a sacrifice. You know, just think of it like this. We say Christ is our Passover. Christ isn't the calendar day, is he? But he is our sacrifice. He is our atoning sacrifice. He died for our sins. He was sacrificed for us. That's what makes him our Passover, because he's a sacrifice. But just to see what happens during that window of time, turn over to Exodus chapter 12. And we'll see here, once again, the Bible defines for us what Passover is. We're going to start reading here in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 3. Now, as we read through this section of verses, I want you to pay particular attention to the word it that you're going to see multiple times. And the reason I'm pointing that out is when we get to verse 11, it's going to tell you that it is Jehovah's Passover. What I want you to see here as we read through this is it's going to keep talking about you kill it, you roast it, you prepare it. It's referring to a lamb. It's referring to a sacrifice, because Passover, by definition, is a sacrifice. Now, start off here in Exodus 12 and verse 3. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to this house take it according to the number of persons, according to each man's need, and you shall make your account for the lamb. And your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Again, notice he keeps referring to it. The it is the lamb. And verse 6, now you shall keep it, the lamb, until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. Again, that's Ben Harbihim. That's between the two evenings. This is what takes place in the window of time that's called the appointed time of Passover, because Passover is a sacrifice by definition. Then they shall take some of the blood and cut it into the doorpost and on the lintel and the houses where they eat it. Notice you're going to eat it, and it, as we're going to see in verse 11, is the Passover. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat it raw or boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head and its legs and its entrails. And you shall let none of it remain until morning, and what remains of it until morning shall burn with fire. And notice very consistently as we read through these verses, it is always referring to the lamb. It's the lamb that sacrificed that's referred to as it. Now let's read verse 11. And you shall eat it with a belt on your waist and your sandals on your feet and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is Jehovah's Passover. In other words, the Passover is the lamb. You know, and that's why we refer to eating the Passover, because you're eating the lamb. Now, biblically, there's basically two definitions for eating the Passover. You know, one is eating a lamb that was again sacrificed at the temple according to the biblical instructions. You know, that's one definition. The other is eating, you know, bread and wine as symbols of Christ in his blood and body, you know, because he is our Passover. They're basically the two definitions. You know, now, as I mentioned that, because sometimes in our modern day, I'll hear people say, well, we're going to have a Passover meal. And what they're referring to is they're going to go to the grocery store and get a leg of lamb and cook it and eat it one night, and they're going to call that Passover. That's not eating the Passover by biblical definition, because the Passover is a sacrifice. And a lamb that you bought at the grocery store and then you cook for a meal, that's not Passover. You know, Passover is either a lamb that you've sacrificed at the temple according to biblical instructions, or again, since Christ is our Passover for the new covenant, it's bread and wine as symbols of his blood and body. That's eating the Passover. But one of the points I'm making here is, as I mentioned from the beginning of the sermon, trying to get us to understand the difference between appointed times and Sabbaths or holy convocations. As we can see here, the Bible is pointed out Passover as one of the appointed times. But the appointed time it singles out is the time of the sacrifice, because that is the definition of Passover. Because oftentimes, see, what we can look at this, and because of really poor English translations, we get it in our head that the term Passover, well, that comes from passing over, you know, and then we get in our head, okay, well that's, you know, the term Passover, that's referring to the death of the firstborn. Well, that's connected with it. But no, that's not actually, you know, first of all, that's a poor English translation that confuses us because of the English words. But let's also pay attention to the timing. Because notice we defined Passover as what happens on the 14th between the two evenings. And again, you can argue which theory you think is correct for Ben Harbihim, but there's one thing we're going to see very clearly. You can't get the death of the firstborn to fit into that window of time. The math will not work. And again, this whole logic is based upon some poor English translations that have confused the whole subject. So let's just look over at verse 23 in Exodus 12 here, because this is oftentimes where this whole concept and confusion comes from. It says, for Jehovah will pass through to strike the Egyptians when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the doorpost, Jehovah will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into the houses to strike you. Well, see, we see the wording here, pass over the door, and we hear the term Passover, you know, one word that refers to the sacrifice, and we think, well, okay, well, the sacrifice, that must be named from passing over. No, that's because it's poor English translations involved here is what has taken place, because these are two totally separate concepts that come from two totally separate Hebrew words. Because the Hebrew word that's translated for Passover, the sacrifice, you know, as it's either Pesach or Pesach, you know, depending upon which English, you know, spelling that they give it. It's either P-E-S-A-H or P-E-S-A-C-H. Kind of just depends upon what resource you look to. It's the same Hebrew word, but sometimes they put that extra letter in English. Now, that refers to a sacrifice. The word that's translated as Passover here is Pasa. It's P-A-S-A-H. Now, that word can mean to pass over, like to jump over something, or it can mean to spare or protect something. You know, and we oftentimes read this because they translate it in English as Passover, we think of it as he's jumping over the door. Well, think about this. If it's the destroyer who's going to come in to kill the firstborn, and I've covered in a previous sermon, the destroyer is Satan. He's the one who's going to come in and kill the firstborn. And Jehovah is, it says, to pass over the door. He's stopping the destroyer from coming in. If he jumps over the door, how is that going to work? How does that stop the destroyer from coming in? It doesn't. It doesn't even make logical sense. You know, if you understand that the word can also be translated as to spare or to protect, you know, he's guarding the door, you know, then you realize what he's is essentially, as we put it in English, he's barring the door. He's stopping the destroyer from coming in. You know, so he can't come in to kill the firstborn. That's what's happening here. So realize that the confusion of thinking that the term Passover refers to the sacrifice is somehow connected to the meaning of passing over, that just comes from poor English translations. And again, remember, we started off this sermon pointing out that Passover is an appointed time, because it's listed in Leviticus 23 as an appointed time. That appointed time is on the 14th between the two evenings. Now again, you can argue whichever theory that you want to think Ben Harbahima refers to. The one thing that everyone has to agree on is you cannot get midnight to fit into either one of those theories. So just to turn over to verse 29 here, because this tells you exactly when, you know, the barring the door and stopping the death of the firstborn, you know, for those that were protected by the Passover sacrifice, when that took place. This is Exodus 12, verse 29. And it came to pass at midnight that Jehovah struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, and all of his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. Now notice, this happens at midnight. Again, you can argue either theory of what you think the meaning of Ben Harbahim is. There's one thing for sure. You cannot get midnight to fall into either one of those windows of time. The math just simply will not work. Because the point being here, the appointed time of Passover, again, Passover by definition is a sacrifice. The appointed time refers to that sacrifice. You know, that's what we're getting at here. But this also clears up another subject when we understand the definition of the appointed time of Passover. Because one of the things I've heard a number of people over the years kind of scratch their head over, and some even get completely confused over, is sometimes people will scratch their head and go, okay, well Passover is listed in, you know, in Leviticus 23 with all the other holy days. Why isn't Passover a Sabbath? You know, why isn't the 14th a holy day that, you know, you shall do no work? You know, and some will even assume that it is, you know, a Sabbath holy day by virtue of the fact that it's listed. You know, as you can see here, again, it's an appointed time. It never says anything about a holy convocation, you shall do no work. You know, it just points out the time of the sacrifice as an appointed time. But just to make it a little more clearly, turn over to Mark chapter 15. As we're going to see here, because we know Christ is our Passover. He's killed on the 14th. But if we read the account of what took place there after his death, it becomes very, very clear, 14th is not a Sabbath. You know, again, there's an appointed time for the Passover sacrifice that day, but it's not a Sabbath. And again, just reading the account makes that very clear. And we'll start here in Mark chapter 15 in verse 33. It says, now when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Elo, Elo, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? Some of those who stood by when they heard it said, look, he is calling for Elijah. And when someone ran and filled a sponge full of sour wine, put it on a reed and offered it to him to drink, saying, let him alone, let us see if Elijah will come to take him down. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. The veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood opposite him saw, he cried out like this as he breathed his last and said, truly, this man was the Son of God. There were also some looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, the less, and of Joseph and Salome, who had followed him and ministered to him when he was in Galilee, and many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. Now notice what's stated right after this, because it makes it abundantly clear, 14th is not a Sabbath. Now when evening had come, because it was the preparation day, that is the day before the Sabbath. See, here they are on the 14th, and now the 15th is going to be the first day of unleavened bread. That's a Sabbath. That's a holy day. That's a holy convocation. The 14th, it's not one, because what you're going to see here, they want to get his body down and get him buried before, you know, we get into the Sabbath, because they don't want this, you know, him hanging up there during the Sabbath. Well, this whole conversation is irrelevant if the 14th is a Sabbath. You know, the 14th can fall on a weekly Sabbath. That's another issue we'll address later. But in and of itself is not a Sabbath. So just continue reading in verse 43. Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent council member who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, coming and taking courage, went in to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And Pilate marveled that he was already dead. And summoning the centurion, he asked him if he had been dead for some time. And when he found out that the centurion, he granted the body of Joseph. Then he brought fine linen and took him down and wrapped him in the linen and laid him in a tomb, which he had sown out of the rock, and rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, observed where he had laid. Now, if we read the account in John 19, it's basically a parallel account of this, the exact same events here. It makes it a little more clearly that, again, the Sabbath the next day was a high day, because, again, we're referring to the first day of unleavened bread was the Sabbath that they were anticipating happening the next day. So turn over to John chapter 19, and we're going to start reading in verse 28. And after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, I thirst. Now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it on his mouth. And then Jesus, who received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. In other words, he died. Therefore, because it was the preparation day, again, we're going to see the day before the Sabbath, that the bodies should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day. See, now we're not talking about the weekly Sabbath. You know, Christ didn't die on a Friday. He died on a Wednesday, and the next day was Thursday, but it was the first day of unleavened bread. That's why it was a Sabbath. And the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. But the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus, they saw he was already dead, and they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. And he who has seen his testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, so he may be that you may believe. For these things were done that the scripture would be fulfilled, not one of his bones shall be broken. And again, another scripture says, they shall look on him whom they pierced. And after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, for the fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took the body of Jesus. And Nicodemus, who was first, came to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. And they took the body of Jesus, bound it in stripes with linen and pieces, so that the custom of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden in the new tomb, which no one had yet been laid. So they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day, for the tomb was nearby. See, it was the preparation day for the first day of unleavened bread. That was going to be a Sabbath because it was a holy day, but the 14th isn't. You know, that's why it was the whole issue of doing this, you know, before the Sabbath came on. But the point I'm making here, as you can see, you know, Passover is a very, very, very significant event. You know, again, you know, the Old Testament, you know, Passover foreshadowed the death of Christ, and now we, you know, look at Christ as our Passover. You know, it's the very sacrifice that enables salvation for all of us. Extremely significant event here, you know, in the plan of salvation for mankind. But God points it out as an appointed time, but not as a Sabbath, not as a holy convocation. You know, again, why God chose to do it that way, that's his call, but that's what the Bible tells us. And again, it's just important to understand that distinction. Well, there's another very important, you know, appointed time that we'll see here in Leviticus 23 that, again, points to a very significant event in the plan of salvation for mankind, but God chose not to make it a Sabbath. You know, he has it as an appointed time, but not as a holy convocation. So let's turn it back over to Leviticus 23. We're going to read to you now about the wave sheaf. Because as we saw, you know, the Passover by definition is a sacrifice. You know, the appointed time was specifically the window of time of offering the sacrifice, and that's what Passover by definition is. The wave sheaf is basically a first fruits grain offering. Again, it has very significant meaning for what it pictures. But again, it's an offering that's done on a particular day, and that day is designated for it. But again, there's nothing said in here about a holy convocation, you shall do no work. So again, we're going to unpack a lot of details as we go through this section of Scripture, because we're going to see not only is there a significance to what, you know, the wave sheaf pictures and its meaning, but it's also pivotal to, you know, understanding this, to getting when Pentecost is correct. Because, you know, the way that we count, you know, the 50 days to get to Pentecost, you got to get Wave Sheaf Sunday right, you know, to be able to arrive at the right date for Pentecost. You know, and as we're going to kind of unpack as we go through this, you know, there's a lot of arguments that oftentimes confuse the subject of how exactly do you do that count to Pentecost. Well, understanding the Wave Sheaf Sunday, and again, particularly what it means, because once we understand what it means, it just really clarifies a lot of the arguments as far as how you do the count. First, we're just going to read through this section of verses here. And again, just pay attention as we read through this, that there's no mention when we describe the details of the wave sheaf of saying, this is a holy convocation, you shall do no work. Those words are just completely missing. Because again, this is not a Sabbath in and of itself. As we're going to see, Wave Sheaf Sunday can fall on the first or last day of unleavened bread, which makes that day a Sabbath because it happened to fall on a holy day. But in and of itself, it's not a holy day. It's starting in verse 9 here of Leviticus 23. And Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when you come into the land which I give to you, reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. Now, this particular verse, or in fact, this whole section of here, doesn't specify what grain we're talking about here. But if you just kind of understand, you know, the time of year and the area of the world where this is taking place, it becomes very obvious what this is, because it's referring to the barley harvest, because that's the only grain, you know, that would be ripe at that time of year that this could be offered. And just to back this up, let me read to you a section from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. I'm sure you probably have heard of that commentary. This is Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary on verse 10 of Leviticus 23. He says, quote, a sheaf of the first fruits, a sheaf and omer of the first fruits of the barley harvest. the barley being sooner ripe than the other grains, the reaping of it formed the commencement of the general harvest season, because previous to that, no Israelite could begin his harvest nor eat of the new grain. Now notice he makes two statements there. You know, not only does he clarify that this is barley, but he says two significant things here. And we're going to see, you know, this becomes particularly important when it comes down to kind of nailing down exactly how to do the count from Wave Sheaf Sunday to Pentecost. Because again, there's a lot of arguments and confusion sometimes about how to do that. And understanding these details just clarifies it. And what I'm referring to here is he makes two claims here. One is you can't eat any of the, you know, the new harvest grain until after the wave sheaf is done. Now, we're going to see that directly stated right here in Leviticus chapter 23, you know, because we're going to see both of the claims he's making here are right out of Scripture. The other is he says, you know, they couldn't, you know, harvest any of the grain until the wave sheaf was offered. Now, that's directly stated in Deuteronomy 16, and we're going to look at both of those. But I just wanted to call this out so you pay attention to that as we're reading through it, because both of those claims come directly from Scripture. And again, that's going to become an important issue when we kind of sort out all the details and some of the controversies of exactly how do you count Pentecost from Wave Sheaf Sunday. But now let's continue on in verse 11 here in Leviticus 23. And he shall wave the sheaf before Jehovah to be accepted on your behalf on the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. Now, we're going to come back to this here in just a little bit, but just notice two details in that particular verse, because they're both very important. One is it mentions the day after the Sabbath. Now, as we're going to see later, there's arguments at times about what Sabbath are we talking about, but we'll sort that out in a minute. But just notice that this has to be done on the day after the Sabbath, so whatever day you're doing on, it's got to be a Sabbath the day prior. And the other is it is offered on your behalf, because that's going to become an important detail to understanding what it actually pictures. And then when we understand what it means and what it pictures, the Sabbath that we're talking about becomes very obvious, because if we look at when it was fulfilled, that just it just clears up all the uncertainty about it. And verse 12, you shall offer on that day, when you wave the sheaf, a male lamb of the first, or the first year, without blemish, as a burnt offering to Jehovah. Its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to Jehovah for a sweet aroma. And its drink offering shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin. And you shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain. Until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God, it shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Now notice I mentioned before, I said there were two things that James Frost and Brown mentioned. One was you can't eat the grain and, you know, for that year's harvest until after you've actually done the wave sheaf offering, and the others you don't harvest. Now that first claim we just read right off the page here. You know, it directly says you can't eat it, you know, until after you've done the wave sheaf. But now let's also sort out a detail here that oftentimes we just read right over because kind of some poor English translation here. Beginning of verse 14 says, you shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain. Now, if you're like me, a lot of my life I read over that and I thought parched grain or fresh grain. Well, that was cooked or non-cooked. You know, so some of it you cooked it, or maybe you ate it raw, you know, and you're thinking that that's the significance of what's happening here. That really doesn't get at the meaning of what we're talking about here. Because if you look into an interlinear in the Hebrew, what it says fresh grain there, the Hebrew word is karmel. Now, what karmel refers to is totally ripe grain. You know, grain that is fully ripe, it's kind of become a hard seed there, and you have to crush it into flour to be able to make food out of it. Now, when you refer to parched grain, this really isn't the concept of, you know, cooked versus non-cooked as we oftentimes think of, you know, you cook something or you eat it raw. You know, that's not really what this is getting at. What this is referring to is grain that's in a status of ripeness that is not fully, it's not totally hard like caramel. It really needs to be dehydrated to get some extra moisture out of it so that you can then use it like caramel and crush it into flour and you use it as food. And as we're going to see, that's a status of ripeness that's typically referred to as aviv. But because what it's referring to here is there's two statuses of ripeness, you know, that you can actually make food from. And we're going to see later here that when it comes to like doing the wave sheaf offering, the same two statuses of ripeness are the qualifications of where grain has to be able to be used as an offering to God. You know, because prior to this, you can't use it for food is kind of what it gets down to. So what we're talking about is Aviv versus Carmel. Again, this isn't really cooked versus non-cooked as we would typically think of it. It's either fully ripe grain or a grain that's, you know, not quite totally ripe. Now, just to kind of clarify this and make this a little easier to understand, turn over to Mark chapter 4, because it helps to kind of understand how grain develops to have a picture of what's really happening here. It's Mark chapter 4. Now, we're going to read here a parable, and again, we're basically kind of pull out a side note here of what Christ is talking about, because he's, you know, obviously making a spiritual point here, but he tells us something about how grain is developed, and this is all very factual, you know, even though, again, Christ's point is really not about the grain, it's about a spiritual lesson. But it's Mark chapter 4 and verse 26. And he said, "The kingdom of God is as if a man should scatter seed on the ground, and should sleep by night and rise by day, and the seed should sprout and grow, he himself does not know how. For the earth yields crops by itself." Now notice the wording here, because this is what's important. "First the blade, then the head, and after that the full grain in the head. But when the grain ripens immediately, he puts the sickle because the harvest has come." What he's explaining here is the normal, you know, I guess, development process of grain. Now, the way this works is with grain, it starts off as a blade of grass, you know, and then as it matures, that blade of grass then develops a head on it, and that head initially has kind of just a fluid substance in it. And then over time, that fluid, you know, slowly congeals and becomes more of a solid. Well, once it reaches the stage of Carmel, you know, it's a hard seed. You know, you basically just take that and, again, pound it into flour and cook, you know, whatever you want to make with it. You know, but just prior to that, in this stage of maturing, it reaches a stage of maturity called Aviv. And basically what that means is that is grain that is not totally, you know, fully ripe to the stage of Carmel, but it's gotten ripe enough now, you know, it's solidified enough that you can parch it in fire, you can roast it, you know, and you're not really trying to cook it. Again, as we would oftentimes think of cooking, what you're doing is dehydrating it. You're basically using heat to then get the extra moisture out of it. And then once you get the extra moisture out of it, now, again, you can use it just like Carmel. You crush it into flour, you know, and you can make food out of it. You know, so that's the concept of what we're getting at here. You know, and as I mentioned before, you know, the wave sheaf offering is a first fruits grain offering. Well, as we're going to see, these two terms, Aviv and Carmel, they're fundamental in understanding a first fruits grain offering, which the wave sheaf is. So turn over to Leviticus chapter 2. We'll understand the details here. Now we're going to break into the middle of context, but you know, if you have a New King James translation of the Bible like I do, you know, your New King James typically has, you know, kind of subheadings, you know, as it kind of breaks down the scripture, giving you kind of subheadings of what the following section is going to address. And at the beginning of chapter 2, you know, it has the subheading the grain offering. You know, because that's what chapter 2 is addressing, is the details of making a grain offering to God. But now focus on verse 14, because that's the verse that's going to be relevant to the point we're making here. "If you offer a grain offering of your first fruits to Jehovah, you shall offer for the grain offering of your first fruits green heads of grain roasted on the fire, and or you know, grain beaten from full heads." Now, again, this is a poor English translation, you know, but because it's obvious if you understand how Aviv grain is, the translators didn't realize what they were saying here. Or they would have never associated green heads with Aviv, because that's just simply totally wrong. But if you look at this in the interlinear, what you're going to see, what it's calling green heads of grain, that's Aviv. And what it's calling full heads, that's Carmel. You know, that's the same word we saw in Leviticus 23. You know, when it called it fresh grain there, that's, again, the same Hebrew word's Carmel. Carmel is your fully ripe grain. Now, again, to define Aviv, let me give you a definition from the Theological Workbook of the Old Testament by Harrison Archer. Here's how they define it. Aviv is, this noun refers to barley that is already ripe but still soft, the grains of which are eaten, either rubbed or roasted. So again, it's the same explanation I was, you know, explaining before, where it's basically, you know, starts off as the fluid inside the head of grain, and then it slowly solidifies, you know, and it becomes more and more of a solid. Well, this has, you know, gone far enough in that, you know, maturing process that you can roast it or parch it in fire, you know, and that'll dehydrate that extra moisture, and now you've got usable food. Prior to that, you know, again, if you tried to roast it, you know, you just burn it up. You wouldn't have anything useful to use. And this is kind of why I comment, whenever you see green heads or green ears, you know, that type of translation for the word Aviv, you immediately know you had an English translator who didn't understand what they were translating. And the easy way to know that is, you know, as I explained before, you know, the grain starts off as a blade of grass and then develops a head and then fully the grain in the head. Well, through that process, it changes colors. And when it originally has the head, you know, that it's developed on it, the head is green. You know, but if you take it at that point and try to roast it in fire, you're not going to have anything useful when you're done, because it's just going to burn up and you're not going to have anything that you can use as food later. To reach the point of Aviv where you can dehydrate it and have useful food, it's going to be a light yellowish color. You know, so it's going to reach that, and then ultimately it'll be more of a golden color when it's fully ripe. So again, if you ever see green heads or green ears, you have an English translator or a commentator who doesn't understand what Aviv barley even looks like, you know, as to what they're talking about here. But another significance, and we'll look at this later, because unfortunately, again, because of the English translations, this is a significance that's totally missed. As we'll see in the latter part of this sermon, you know, this term Aviv, you know, is also directly related to the name that God gives the first month of the biblical year. As we're going to see, he refers to it as the month of the Aviv, you know, or oftentimes in our English translations, it'll have A-B-I-B, you know, but phonetically in Hebrew, it's more A-V-I-V is how it would be correctly pronounced. But because this verse doesn't mention, you know, that word, it just says green heads, you know, you don't even associate what it's talking about here with the name of the month, because you don't realize the same word's being used. Well, there's another key scripture that uses this same word that also kind of helps us understand this. Turn over to Exodus chapter 9. And what we're breaking into the context here is, you know, the plagues that God brought upon the Egyptians. As you know, there was a series of 10 plagues there where, you know, he really just pounded the Egyptians and leveled their whole society. You know, well, one of those plagues was a severe hailstorm. And what we're going to see here is a verse that mentions, you know, kind of the effects of that hailstorm. But again, there's this word Aviv here shows up, but again, the English translators don't acknowledge that. You know, so again, you read right over it and don't even realize what you're reading. Let's read here in Exodus 9, verse 31, and I'm going to read this initially out of the New King James. It says, "Now the flax and the barley were struck, for the barley was in the head and the flax was in bud. But the wheat and the spelt were not struck, for they were late crops." Now the NLT translates verse 31 a little bit more clearly, but let me just read it from verse 31 from that translation. It's the New Living Translation. It says, "All the flax and the barley were ruined by the hail, because the barley had formed heads and the flax was budding." You know, so basically what it's saying is it had developed to the point that, you know, when the hail hit it, it ruined the crop and destroyed it is what it's getting at. But the reason I'm pointing this out is Leviticus 2:14, which we just read, and Exodus 9:31 here, again, give us a biblical definition for this term Aviv. You know, and typically, again, we read over the scriptures, you know, because six times it's the same word is mentioned in reference to the first month of the year, but we don't make any connection with it, because we read it in English and that word doesn't appear, so it just goes right over our heads. You know, so we'll kind of see that later. It's just one of the significant connections that of how the wave sheaf ties into a number of subjects here. But as we've covered, the wave sheaf offering, again, it's not a holy day in and of itself, you know, unless it, you know, happens to fall on a holy day, but it's actually a first fruits grain offering. Well, this grain offering is given a unique title that helps us give some insight as to what it actually pictures and what meaning is behind it spiritually that we should learn from this. So turn over to Exodus 23, and we're going to see here a term that's used for this particular grain offering that again, really helps us to nail down exactly what it's referring to here. Because, when we understand the meaning of what it's pointing towards, again, that just clears up a whole lot of debate, you know, in terms of, you know, how to use Wave Sheaf Sunday to count Pentecost. So to look over at Exodus 23 and verse 17. 3 times in the year, all your males shall appear before the Lord Jehovah. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until morning. Now, there's an obvious reference here to the Passover sacrifice. So we know what time of, you know, general time of year we're talking about. Now, notice verse 14. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of Jehovah your God. Again, now we're basically referring to the wave sheaf here of a grain offering, again, that's brought into the temple to be offered before God. And again, it's around the time frame of when the Passover is. Well, when does Wave Sheaf Sunday fall? You know, during the days of unleavened bread. So the point I want you to see here is it's referring to the wave sheaf as the first of the first fruits. That's an important clue that's going to show us what it's referring to, you know, or what pictures, I should say. Now, we'll see a similar reference here in Exodus 34, and we're going to read verse 25. Again, you can find this very similar to the verses we just read. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leaven, you know, nor shall the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover be left until morning. Okay, again, very, very clearly stated. Now, we know we're talking about the Passover sacrifice. But now notice what's mentioned right afterwards, because again, we're in a similar time frame. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of Jehovah your God. Well, what did we read in Leviticus 23? When you get into the land, you shall cut, you know, the first fruits of your harvest, you shall bring it to, you know, before the Lord. Okay, this is the wave sheaf offering. That's what we're referring to here. But notice once again, what is it referred to as? The first of the first fruits. Now, if we just focus in on that particular title, that's going to give us a big clue as to what the wave sheaf offering pictures. Because who does the Bible refer to as the first of the first fruits? Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And we're going to start in verse 20. Now, Christ is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. But each one in his own order. Christ the first fruits, afterwards those who are Christ at his coming. I notice Christ is referred to as first fruits, but also mentions those who are his at his coming. Well, that group is referred to as first fruits as well. Turn over to Revelation chapter 14 in verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder, and I heard this sound of harpists playing their harps. And they sang as it were a new song before the throne, before the living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins, and they are ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These are the redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Notice they're referred to as first fruits. These are redeemed from the earth. They follow Christ. These are those who are Christ at his coming, and they're called first fruits as well. Well, again, if Christ is the first fruits and these are first fruits as well, he's the first of the first fruits, you know, because he's before all of us. But now also notice, you notice I mentioned before when we read Leviticus 23, verse 11, you take note of the fact that the wave sheaf is offered on our behalf. So let's just quickly turn back to Leviticus 23, and we're going to see this detail, just so we have this in our mind. Because then what we're going to look for is who's called the first of the first fruits, who's also offered on our behalf. It's Leviticus 23 in verse 11. Again, it's just reviewing the details of the wave sheaf here. And he shall wave the sheaf before Jehovah to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. So now let's notice again, who is the first of the first fruits who's offered on our behalf? So let's just turn over to Hebrews chapter 9. Now the account we're going to read here beginning in verse 11 is again explaining the ceremony that's performed on the Day of Atonement. You know, but as I've mentioned in a number of sermons, you know, Passover and the wave sheaf, again, is specific in terms of its application, you know, to the first fruits who were called prior to the return of Christ. The rest of mankind is then, you know, these same concepts are addressed in the Day of Atonement, you know, as this the sacrifice of Christ is then applied to the rest of mankind. But again, if we just read here in starting in verse 11, we'll see the account of how Christ goes before the Father on our behalf to offer himself as a sacrifice. And so verse 11, but Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling the unclean sacrifices for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And for this reason, he is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, and those who are called may receive the promise of eternal inheritance. See, Christ is the first of the first fruits, and he's offered on our behalf. He goes before the Father, you know, to basically pay the penalty for all of our sins to enable us to have the opportunity to receive salvation. So we know what the wave sheaf now pictures. Because if we just put together, again, the first of the first fruits who's offered on our behalf, well, that's obviously Christ. And as we're going to see, he fulfills that during the days of unleavened bread, which is exactly when the wave sheaf is offered. But now let's notice specifically when it happened. Turn over to John chapter 20. And see, this is going to nail down for us exactly what day all that this took place. And again, this just clarifies all the arguments, you know, around exactly how to count Pentecost. This is John chapter 20 and verse 11. Now this is if you have a New King James translation of the Bible, you'll see the beginning of chapter 20, it says the empty tomb. You know, we're referring to now the Sunday after, you know, this is the day that, you know, after Christ has been resurrected, because, you know, he's in the grave, you know, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. At the end of Saturday, he's resurrected back to life. You know, this is that next, you know, morning when they're discovering that the tomb's empty, the guy's not here anymore. You know, so now let's notice in verse 11. But Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping. As she wept, she stood down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. And then they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said to them, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, and did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" And she, supposing him to be a gardener, said to him, Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. And Jesus said to her, Mary. And she turned and said to him, Rabboni, which is to say, teacher. And Jesus said to her, Do not cling to me, for I have not ascended to my Father. Now notice that he doesn't allow her to touch him. And he says, the reason why is I haven't ascended to the Father yet. That's the reason you can't do it. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father and to my God and to your God. And Mary Magdalene came and told his disciples that he had spoken to the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. I notice again, here we are on Sunday. You know, again, Christ is resurrected at the end of the Sabbath on Saturday. You know, well now here we are on Sunday morning, and he's saying, don't touch me because I haven't gone to the Father yet. But now let's notice what happens later that day. Turn over to Matthew 28 in verse 9. And as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, Rejoice. And they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. Notice he lets them touch him. And Jesus said to them, Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. So obviously, you know, prior to this, he's saying, Don't touch me. I haven't been to the Father yet. Now he's letting people touch him and doesn't have a problem with it. Obviously, we can deduce, you know, between these two accounts, he ascended to the Father. He went and fulfilled the wave sheet. He basically fulfilled what we just read in Hebrews chapter 9. Now, this clears up a whole lot of issues for us. Because, you know, the other big significance that comes with Wave Sheaf Sunday is that's the day you have to start the count to Pentecost. But oftentimes, there's a lot of debate as to, okay, what exactly is the right day, and how do we understand when it is? Well, now we know, you know, when it was actually fulfilled, and it was fulfilled on a Sunday during the days of unleavened bread. Well, this just clears up a whole lot of argument. So let's turn over now to Leviticus 23. This is Leviticus 23, and we're going to read now the first couple of verses addressing Pentecost. But as we're going to see here, it specifically says you got to use Wave Sheaf Sunday, you know, to start counting from to be able to determine when to keep Pentecost. In verse 15, And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Now notice we're clearly talking about Wave Sheaf Sunday here now, you know, because it specifically mentions the wave sheaf, and it says it's the day after the Sabbath. In verse 16, count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath, and then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. You shall bring from your habitations 2 wave loaves, 2/10 of an ephah, and they shall be of fine flour, and they shall be baked with leaven, and they are the first fruits to Jehovah. Now again, that's referring to the 2 wave loaves that was a ceremony done at Pentecost. We're not going to get into that today. But just notice, when he talks about the count to Pentecost, he says you start counting from the day after the Sabbath, and you have to end on the day after the Sabbath. You have to count 50 days, and there have to be 7 full weeks. Well, again, oftentimes there's a lot of arguments as to what's the day after the Sabbath where you start this count from. In fact, the common Jewish explanation for that today is that the day after the Sabbath, you know, the Sabbath in question would be the first day of unleavened bread. So then you always start from the second day of unleavened bread. Well, that's where, you know, their concept of Sivan 6 comes from, you know, because it's just the math that gets you to the 6th day of Sivan will always be, you know, the day that Pentecost is if you're using that logic. But again, if we just look at when did Christ fulfill it, we know that Christ is what's being, you know, basically pictured here in this grain offering. Well, we know when Christ did it. He did it on a Sunday in the middle of the days of unleavened bread. Well, that just happens to be the day after the weekly Sabbath. And if you start counting from that day and you count 50, well, where are you going to land? You're going to land on a Sunday again after completing 7 full weeks, and you're going to land on the day after the Sabbath. Notice that it matches all of the criteria, and it's going to match out exactly what it says. And again, if we just focus on what it means and what it pictures, well, then that just clears up all the other arguments and the debates that you can make. Because again, it's kind of the trump card argument, right? Say when you realize it pictures Christ, and when did Christ fulfill it? Well, that just clears everything up. Well, there's one other argument that often comes into play here. And again, that's the argument of, okay, well, what about a situation where the first day of unleavened bread is a Sunday? Well, do you count from that Sunday, or do you count from the Sunday that would be after the last day of unleavened bread? You know, because if you're counting from the first day of unleavened bread, well, that means the Sabbath is the day of the Passover sacrifice, that you'd be talking about. Well, which one's correct? And there's lots of arguments around that. Well, this is one of the reasons why I pointed out earlier, and I pointed out from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, he said there were two significant things. One is you can't eat the grain, before you do the wave sheaf offering, and you can't harvest the grain. Now, again, we're going to see here in a minute that's in Deuteronomy 16, but these facts are important because this helps us to understand a reference in the book of Joshua that just clears up this whole debate. Turn over to Joshua chapter 5. And this is basically the account of the Israelites just, beginning to enter the promised land. But again, if you remember that detail, they can't eat the grain until they offered the wave sheaf. Now, that clarifies an important issue for us here. So the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight in the plains of Jericho. And they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Now the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Notice, a major portion of their diet up to this point had been manna, just food falling from the sky 6 days a week. But now they're actually in the land and they can reap the harvest and they can be fed from the land itself. But as we know, they were specifically told you can't eat of it, until you've done the wave sheaf. Well, we know that it explicitly tells us they're eating this on the first day of unleavened bread. Well, if they follow the instructions, that means the wave sheaf offering had to be done before they could eat this. That tells you that the prior day of the Passover sacrifice on the 14th, that was the weekly Sabbath, and this is a Sunday, is the first day of unleavened bread. So that kind of solves this whole issue. But there's another important detail we oftentimes, kind of read right over it in this and miss as well. Notice it specifically mentions they're eating parched grain. Now, as I mentioned before, this isn't, we just chose to cook it. We cooked it by parching versus cooking it some other way. No, that's dehydrating it, to get the extra moisture out of it, because you're talking about Aviv grain. You're talking about grain that hasn't quite reached Carmel, it's Aviv, and that's why you're drying it out, so that you can make flour out of it and make food out of it. Now, also remember, when the Israelites came in, this is a large number of people. So when you basically say that, point out that all these people are eating the parched grain, the Aviv, there was a lot of Aviv, on the very early end of the harvest, you could say, because there wasn't a ton of Carmel for them to be eating. They're eating lots of Aviv because, again, they're at the beginning of the barley harvest is what this is telling us, because that's another detail the Bible gives us in the count of Pentecost. Now turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 16. We'll notice here again this count to Pentecost is specifically mentioned here in Deuteronomy 16. But it gives us another detail here that, again, ties into everything we've talked about. And again, also it sheds a little light on what we just read there in Joshua. Deuteronomy 16 in verse 9. You shall count 7 weeks for yourself. Again, the same 7-week count we just read in Leviticus 23. Begin the count 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the grain. Then you shall keep the Feast of Weeks to Jehovah your God with a tribute of a freewill offering from your land, which you shall give to Jehovah your God blesses you. Now again, let me read to you the verse 9 out of the New Revised Standard Version, because it's translated just a little bit more clearly. So you shall count 7 weeks. Begin to count 7 weeks from the time the sickle is first put to the standing grain. Now think about this logically. You got to do an exact 50-day count. Now, if you're going to do an exact 50-day count, it's important that you start on the right day so that you can end on the right day. And it's describing that day as when you first put the sickle to the standing grain. It's telling you that that's when you start the barley harvest, is on that day. This is why Jameson, Frost, and Brown mentioned that particular detail, is because this is when the barley harvest starts. And again, you can see this is consistent with what we just read in Joshua chapter 5, this huge group of people. What are they eating? They're eating parched grain. They didn't just chia. That's not, we chose to parch it versus baking versus, you know, boiling or, you know, some other kind of cooking. No, that's we dehydrated it because it was Aviv grain. Maybe because, again, this particular detail, again, as we're going to see, kind of ties into how the first month of the year is named. But just so you understand, I'm not making more out of that detail, you know, of how that's translated there in Deuteronomy 16, verse 9. Let me just briefly read to you a couple of historical quotes from Jewish history that totally match what I've just laid out here. This is from Josephus, Antiquity of the Jews, Book 3, Chapter 10. It says, quote, "And while they suppose it proper to honor God, from whom they obtain this plentiful provision, in the first place, they offer the first fruits of their barley, and after this it is that they may publicly or privately reap their harvest." In other words, he's directly saying that they couldn't harvest until after the wave sheaf, is what Josephus is saying. Now, this is also recorded in the Babylonian Talmud. So this is the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sanhedrin 11b. It says, quote, "The new crop may be harvested and eaten only after the sacrifice of the Omer offering." So again, you couldn't do it until after you'd actually done the harvest. Now, the reason I point all this out is we oftentimes read over the name that the Bible gives for the first month of the year and totally miss the significance of what it's actually saying, because we don't understand this term Aviv. Now, turn over to Exodus chapter 23. We'll briefly look at this. And what I want you to notice in particular as well is who actually uses this particular term. Now, the reason I mention that is, you know, today we oftentimes refer to the first month of the year by calling it the month of Nisan. And again, the Bible does use that term. It shows up in the book of Esther and the book of Nehemiah. You know, but the reason I'm pointing that out is the current names that are associated with the months typically on the Jewish calendar today, you know, these are Babylonian names. You know, these really didn't come into practice, you know, until the Babylonian captivity and going forward from there. You know, if you pay attention to how the Bible refers to months, it's first month, second month, third month, they're numbered. You know, so if you break the pattern and you give a month a particular name, he's telling you to pay attention to that particular name. You know, and I also want you to notice here who's actually using this name, because it's going to come directly from the mouth of God. You know, so this isn't just a nickname that Moses gave it, or, you know, just was a cultural reference. No, this is going to come specifically from the mouth of God. Notice here, this is in Exodus 23 and verse 14. "Three times you shall keep a feast to me in the year." Now, again, it's real obvious who me is. This is God himself talking. In verse 15, "You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, and as I command you, at the time appointed in the month of the Aviv. For in it you came out of Egypt, none of you shall appear before me empty." And notice when I read that, I said the month of the Aviv. You typically don't see "the," you know, in the English translations. That's a detail they just skipped right over. The month is referred to with this term 6 times. We won't look at all of those references. But it's referred to 6 times in Moses' writings here. And if you look it up in an interlinear, it's going to say Ha Aviv, because Ha is Hebrew for the. It's saying it's the month of the Aviv is the title that he's giving it. Because once you understand this connection again with Wave Sheaf Sunday and the barley harvest taking place at that time, you understand why he's saying this. Because this is the month that will be identified by the barley is going to be Aviv. It's going to be at that status, and nature itself and the holy days correlate with each other. In fact, if you turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 16, he specifically kind of calls this out and says, you know, notice this correlation. This is basically the Creator saying, you know, I created nature, I made nature, and the holy days I told you to make to correlate with each other. You know, as I oftentimes like to joke, I have a sarcastic sense of humor. You know, when I see correlations like this, I like to joke and go, you know, it's almost like some great master planner designed it like that. You know, because that's literally what he's pointing out to us, is that he designed it like that. And if you read verse 1 of Deuteronomy 16, it says, observe the month of the Aviv. Keep the Passover to Jehovah your God. For in the month of the Aviv, Jehovah your God brought you out of Egypt by night. You know, notice he specifically says, observe the month of the Aviv. Now, let me cover for you the meaning of the Hebrew word there translated as observe. It's Samar, S-A-M-A-R, and Strong's number 8104. And the definition I'm going to give you is from the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter. It says, quote, a verb meaning to watch, to keep, to preserve, to guard, to be careful, to watch over, to watch carefully over, to be on one's guard. The Hebrew word means to maintain or to observe something for a purpose and is followed by another verb indicating the purpose or manner. So he's saying, observe this, you know, pay attention to the month of the Aviv. Well, why? Because that's when you're going to keep Passover. That's what he's calling out here. It's basically just the Creator showing us, see, look what I did. I made nature and the holy days correlate with each other. That's how I designed it. He's basically just calling that out to us. Well, but as I mentioned, the purpose of this whole sermon was, again, to get us to pay a little more attention to Leviticus chapter 23. Because oftentimes when we read over this particular chapter, you know, we just kind of assume that, well, everything listed here, well, it's all holy days. Well, the holy days are listed, yes, but there's also appointed times that he lists out here that are very significant. As we can see, Passover and the wave sheaf, these directly tie to, you know, Jesus Christ and his role and what he did for us in the plan of salvation. They're not inconsequential at all. These are monumental things, you know. But for whatever reason, God chose to make them appointed times, you know, rather than holy convocations. So I just wanted to point this out. So, you know, since we're in that time of year where we're keeping, you know, all of these days, and so I just thought it would be important for us to understand this so we can understand the plan that he has designed for us.